Since we launched the brand new Renegade University a few weeks ago, the world has changed. We have new courses, new faculty, many, many new students who are joining this new revolution in higher education. We have a new, unique educational platform that features video courses, one-on-one interaction with instructors, and a plethora of live events across the country. And right now, as part of our grand new launch, we're offering 30 to 40% off everything at the brand new Renegade University. To experience RU 2.0, go to renegadeuniversity.com. This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and to expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. For the 100th episode of Unregistered, we decided to have a very special guest on the show. Listeners. So we conducted a very special live stream episode of Unregistered on YouTube, featuring questions, comments, and even criticisms from our listeners. This is my conversation with listeners of the Unregistered Podcast. We are live. Good to see everyone here. Lily is the moderator once again. So I have a little story to say before we start. I was driving to the studio just now, and I was on the phone with my son. I was telling him about how this was my 100th episode live stream podcast. And I was saying how excited I was to talk about 100 years, 2.5 years, 100 episodes of Unregistered. And he said, "Dad, you heard the news." I said, "Oh God, I knew what was happening." Or I had a sense of what was happening. And he told me, and I wouldn't be surprised if the United States kills a bunch of people by the time this live stream is over. I hope not, but I wouldn't be surprised given the way the Trump administration has been toward Iran. For those of you who don't know, the news just came in that Iran has taken responsibility for the bombing of, I guess they sent missiles, about 10 missiles. Please correct me. This is brand new news, so I don't know exactly. I think it's 10 missiles were sent toward the Al-Assad base in Iraq, which is an American military base. And I believe, at least my son told me, that this was the base that Trump just visited over Thanksgiving. If this is true, if I got this wrong, let me know. And I'm assuming my volume's okay. Everyone can hear me. If you can't, please let me know. Great to see you guys. So let's do a few things here. Clearly, we have a new thing on the agenda, but this is the 100th episode of Unregistered, and I decided that the 100th episode should not just be with a regular guest. It should be with the most important people for Unregistered, which is you. And so it's, you know, there's no question that this would not be, there would not be a 100th episode without the great fan response, listener response that this show has gotten over the last 2.5 years. We began in April of 2017. First episode was, everyone knows this, right? Michael Malice. Second episode, Camille Foster. Third episode was Maggie McNeil, I think. And then fourth episode, I believe, was Jonathan Karp, which was when I started crying. And I started crying in that episode. Guess what? About what? About war and about the horrible deaths that John witnessed as a combat medic in Baghdad, in Iraq. And it was one of the most deeply affecting things I'd ever heard, of course. But, you know, I became anti-war when I was about 15 years old. I was reading a book about World War One. I don't remember why, but it was a description of the battles in World War One, the Battle of the Somme, I think I remember reading about then, and just the absolute horrors of it. And one night when I was that age, I had a dream, a very involved dream about being in World War One, being a soldier in World War One. And the dream was me on a battlefield, and there was the barbed wire and the mustard gas and the machine guns. And it just terrified me to my core. And that was before I'd read anything about World War II, which was even worse. But that's the beginning of my anti-war commitment. I had not really thought much about politics or war before then. I mean, my parents were socialists, and so they were anti-Vietnam War, and I marched as a baby in anti-Vietnam War protests in the Bay Area, and I'm proud of that, sort of, although I don't think it's a good idea to use children as political props, but, you know, that one, I'm glad I was there, and I'm glad that my parents were very much anti-war. We had posters in our house about the Vietnam War and about how it should end immediately, so, you know, it's not new to me, although that was more sort of just the general ideology of left-wing socialists in the 1960s in Berkeley. But as a visceral thing, as an emotional commitment, as an emotional aversion, a deep aversion to war, and great fear of war, that's when it began. So it's almost a lifelong project, commitment, feeling that I've had that's driven a lot of my work, a lot of my ideas. As probably all of you know, this is something that's on my mind a lot. I pay attention to foreign policy. I pay attention to war. I care about it quite a bit. And I've had not enough guests, oddly, on the show who are experts on foreign policy. I've had several. And of course, the great, great Scott Horton, who deserves a shout out anytime there's a foreign policy crisis, anytime we are on the verge of war, or even not, he deserves a shout out, because without Scott, I don't know where we would be as an anti-war movement, frankly. And that goes for the left and the right, for lefties and righties who are anti-war. Scott is still, I think, the hub for the true anti-war movement, not the people like the liberals and the Democrats these days who are, or today in the last few days, who have been pretending to be anti-war because of Trump being the war maker this time instead of one of their own, like Hillary or Barack or Bill or especially Lyndon Baines Johnson, who really, it's amazing. If you were to ask a liberal, ask an American, forget a liberal, ask an American who is, which president started, continued, is largely responsible for the Vietnam War, they'll almost all say Richard Nixon. It's kind of like the way that the Yemen genocide is blamed entirely on Trump, when we know full well, in fact, the New York Times reported on this, that it began with Barack Obama, Samantha Power, Hillary Clinton saying, "Go for it, Saudis, bomb the fuck out of those poor Yemenis." Because why? Because it was believed at the time by John Kerry, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, Samantha Power, all of them, Hillary, that the Yemenis who were opposed to the Saudi regime were basically proxies for the Iranian regime. Okay, so that, and you can look this up, we did an episode about this, Scott and I, but it was reported on in the New York Times, I think this was in 2015, maybe it was either 2014 or 2015 when the Obama administration decided to give the okay and to give material and military support to the Saudi regime to annihilate the Yemeni people, essentially. this conflict, this present conflict with Iran, of course, the conflict with Iran goes back to 1953 when the CIA overthrew Mossadegh, Mohammad Mossadegh, and replaced him with the Shah. And the Shah used the CIA's advice and training to develop very sophisticated torture techniques, which they used against primarily communists and Muslim radical activists like the Ayatollah, the guy who became the Ayatollah Khomeini. Yeah. So this has a longer history, a much, much longer history than Trump. And it is most certainly not a Republican project, what has been going on between the United States and Iran. I'd say it's roughly equal. But the current crisis, I believe, and this is, I think, just clear, you know, began with the Obama administration giving the okay to essentially attack what they believe to be the proxies in Yemen. But by extension, you know, they were attacking in some senses the proxies in Iran. I mean, I'm sure there are sympathizers among the Yemenis with Iran for a lot of good reasons, because Iran and Saudi Arabia are mortal enemies, and Yemenis of many kinds are consider themselves rightly to be oppressed by the Saudis. Yeah, my commitment to war, back to that, goes all the way back. It's a lifelong thing. They say commitment to war, commitment to anti-war. Am I anti-war, or am I anti-imperialist, or am I just opposed to all the American wars? Well, let's answer those in turn, from the last one to the first one. I do, as a historian, I have studied and I've written about all the American wars since the founding, including the founding. And yeah, not a single one of them I support, not a single one of them, this goes for the Civil War as well, not a single one of them I think was justified, not a single one of them I think represented an act of self-defense, which would be to me the only justifiable use of military force against another country. So here's what we need to do. We need to talk constantly. We need to yell constantly. And we actually need to get into the streets. I want everyone to remember when Obama was about to bomb Syria. The year was about, 2014, 15, 13, somewhere. Anyway, it was right then. Obama was right on the verge of sending missiles into Syria. And we filled the streets. People forget this. There was an actual anti-war movement, a real powerful anti-war movement. It was brief. It's only about a week or two, but I was in protests in LA. There were many protests all over the country. We filled the streets, and this was the left, the right, all sorts of political persuasions. That was universally, almost universally condemned Obama's idea of bombing Syria by Americans of all political persuasions. It was one of the most exciting, maybe the most exciting political movement I have seen in the last decade. And because it was so large, and because amazingly for a movement like that, it was successful. Obama did not bomb Syria. And it was pretty clear he did that because he saw that there was zero political support and popular support for it. And we deserve credit, meaning those of us who were against it, those of us who are marching in the streets, and I'm talking about hundreds of thousands, possibly millions of people, but either marching in the streets or simply voicing their opposition to this. So that's what has to happen now. And it can happen. I think that Trump, the nice thing about Trump is that he does change his mind, actually, and that he can be swayed pretty quickly if he gets his heartstrings pulled in a particular way. And, you know, usually it's Ivanka who does that on our behalf for the good things, you know, like with immigration, not with what was the stupid thing she did that she made him do? I forget that we all were mad. Oh, vaping. Yeah, not something stupid like that. But, you know, I think he softened on immigration. He did soften on immigration on the Dreamers, especially apparently because of Ivanka. Well, we need more than just his daughter to push the dude, because he can be pushed and he's very aware. I think he's very sensitive to what the people are thinking and feeling, and he's not going to push this war if there is a mass opposition to it. Now, here's what's going to happen, and it's already started happening because I just saw reports about what's going on in MSNBC right now, the big liberal cable news show. They're already saying that we must respond to the rocket attacks on the military base with overwhelming force. I know that the liberal General McCaffrey, who's a regular talking head on MSNBC, the big liberal cable news show, just said that. At least that was what was on Twitter. I'll bet you anything that Democrats largely will fall in line with Trump if he does want to attack Iran in retaliation for this. Why is the United States, why is the Trump administration doing this? Why is it interested in, not interested, I would say they're obsessed, the foreign policy wing of the administration, the generals and some of the civilian advisors around Trump, why are these guys so intent on going after Iran, provoking them into some sort of military conflict? It's hard to understand, and it sort of speaks to how simply this is in some ways a good thing about Trump, simply unsophisticated he is about foreign policy and his advisors around him, and especially the generals, right? Now, John Bolton, he's gone, and apparently he's going to testify in Trump's impeachment hearings, which is very interesting. I can't wait to see what that's about. I can guess what it's about. The reason Bolton is going to testify is that he understood that Trump was only moderately, insufficiently committed to the imperial project, which Bolton is really into, you know, in conquering, invading, landing troops, occupying, remaking places. Bolton is not quite a full blown neocon, but he is he's certainly in line with them on a lot of that regime change idea, which is just old fashioned imperialism repackaged as regime change. That's what we call it now, and nation building. It's imperialism, you know. Period. So that's I think. I think it's largely an emotional reaction from what I understand, you know, from listening to Scott's show and learning a lot about Iran and especially the foreign policy thinkers in the Trump administration who are pushing the hawkish line on Iran. It sounds like it's basically revenge for the attack on the Marine base in 1983 in Lebanon. Apparently a lot of the people around Trump lost friends, comrades, soldiers under their command in that attack. Several hundred Marines were killed. I think there have been other attacks that were attributed to Iran since then in which American service members were killed. And I think according to Scott and many of his guests, many of them have some connection to the foreign policy people, the Joint Chiefs and the people in the Pentagon who are close to Trump and have his ear. I mean, it really, and you know, and this is sort of the way Trump operates, right? I mean, it's often very emotional. It's often about sort of pride and masculine identity and, you know, this threat to America, which is a threat to his own identity in some way or another. Now, that's idiotic. If there is such a thing as toxic masculinity, I'm going to say that's it, right? If your masculine ego gets bruised by what some foreign country does that's largely irrelevant to us, you know, unless we want to park our military bases right next to them, you know, it's the guy is fairly childish. Now, that's during the election and right after he was elected, and I was on the Reason podcast to explain this, and I've talked about it elsewhere, and I've been attacked for it. You know, that's actually preferable, believe it or not. Now, not if he drops nukes on Iran and kills everybody in that country. It's nothing's preferable to that, but it is, or that is not preferable to anything. But I think that the fact that he is unsophisticated means that he has no, and here's the thing, he has no grand plan. He has no grand strategy, which is what foreign policy leaders, policymakers in the United States have always had, at least for since the Spanish-American War in 1898. It's never been just ad hoc acts of revenge. There's always been a grand plan to establish, maintain, and enlarge the American Empire. Actually, this goes back to Thomas Jefferson and George Washington and John Adams and Ben Franklin. This is what they were talking about as well. this is what the establishment of the United States of America was. It was an act of imperialism. All the people within the borders of those 13 colonies now became Americans without their say. In the more than 90% of the people had no say in that, right? This included ex-slaves. This included a lot of British loyalists. This included all sorts of people who had nothing to do with the revolution and didn't want to. They were just farmers and they lived in cities or whatever. But they draw where all of a sudden there was lines drawn around where they lived, and they were told that they were Americans with these rights, which were great, but a whole bunch of responsibilities, like you got to serve in the war next time we have one, which, you know, turned out to be a pretty big one, the Civil War, right? Which killed 500,000 Americans, and many of those people were drafted. The conscripts, the draft. So if the United States goes to war with Iran, and, you know, this is something that my son and I, he's 18 years old, and I've mentioned this many times, you know, we've talked about what the chances are of a draft happening. And I know that the Selective Service website crashed because there were so many people going there to find out, apparently this is what was reported, to find out how to get exempt from the draft. Makes my heart very warm. I've been hearing from just friends around here in Oakland, you know, and by the way, locally, there's very little attention to foreign policy over the last several years. It's all just sort of navel gazing about hurt feelings about identity, and very little about, you know, actual killing of people and abroad. But finally, you know, when someone like Trump does something like this, they get anti-war. So there's been a lot of anti-war talk and yelling going on in the Bay Area right now, which is fine. It's just that as soon as their person wins, I'm going to remind them of that. Especially when their person is someone like Hillary Clinton, which it almost certainly will be. So, a draft. Will a draft happen? To me, I think it's just very clear. If the United States foreign policy thinkers, policymakers decide that they need to actually control territory, that's when they need large numbers of troops on the ground. And for the big Iraq war, it was about 500,000 on the ground to occupy that territory. That was unsuccessful, as we all know. Catastrophe, essentially. Didn't result in what they wanted. In fact, Iran basically has more control over Iraq than the United States does now. As Scott Horton has many times pointed out, rightly, it just worked against them. So 500,000 troops didn't do the job. And I don't know if they want to do this, but if they want to actually do to Iran what Bush tried to do to Iraq, then they're going to know that it requires, and that's a much larger country with a much more powerful military, by the way. They're going to need to draft people to get more than 500,000 troops to occupy that sucker. I mean, just to control Tehran alone, that's a major metropolis, cosmopolitan metropolis, which is another reason I don't think it's going to happen. And here's the real goddamn story, Donald fucking Trump. Listen to me. I've said this before, but I'm saying it again. Read the news, you fucking asshole. Read the fucking news. Read the fucking news about what's going on in Iran, on the streets, among the people over the last several years. Anybody who says that this is a justified war, that there's any reason to attack or provoke or start anything with that regime, simply is ignorant and murderously ignorant. If you read anything about what the Iranian people, especially those under 30 years old or even under 40 years old, are thinking and doing these days and have been for years, there is nothing to fear. In fact, I feel more pity for the rulers of that regime than anything else, because their days are numbered. It's just a question of how long it will take. Now, here's a great way. Oh, because, sorry, if people don't know, I mean, women by the hundreds of thousands are throwing off their veils in public. Many of them are taking off their veils and throwing them at the Islamic Sharia police. There are discos, there are tattoo parlors, there are piercing parlors, there's a massive hip hop scene that is critical of the regime, that couldn't care less about Islam, that raps about all the good stuff like sex and partying and drinking. There's very clearly, if you've been following this, been reading the news reports, very clearly very, very little interest in being a good Muslim among most Iranians, especially those who are young, which is most of the country. It's a very young population, by the way. Now, if your whole youthful population, or most of your youthful population, is more interested in playing video games and watching porn than listening to a mullah's speech, you know, about the great Satan, then, you know, they're toast. They're toast. This regime cannot last. I mean, we've also had these massive protests in the streets recently about the economic crisis in Iran. It's just infuriating. All right. Let's take some questions. Sorry, I haven't been looking at the chats. What else did I miss, guys? There's more to say, of course. I don't think Trump will choose to, who knows? I mean, his ambitions, I hope, are limited. Here's the good news about Trump. Again, you know, his general tendency in foreign policy has been to bluff and to talk big, be the bad cop, threaten things, be full of bluster. We're going to blow you up. We're going to do this, do that. Like with North Korea was a great example. Hoping, and so far this has actually worked for him on his own terms, you know, and hoping that they will back down, because these regimes may be crazy and totalitarian, but they ain't stupid. And they know that the United States could kill anyone in any of those countries at any moment. The United States could kill anyone in any of those countries at any moment. They could blow up any building at any moment. They can do whatever they want to those countries. And they know it. The leaders of those countries know that. So I'm hoping that's what's going on here. I would be surprised if he doesn't launch some retaliatory attack. I hope it is only against a military base. Even that I find disgusting and abhorrent, and I'm utterly opposed to it. And I would still march in the streets, as I did with Syria, about even that. I'm hoping, though, that that's what we get, because I think that's the best we can get at this point. I don't see him just not responding to this militarily. He's going to kill somebody, or at least kill some buildings. So hopefully it'll just be buildings. But I imagine, even by the end of this live stream, that some people will be dead in Iran, cut to pieces by American steel, shrapnel, explosions, whatever, incineration. I don't know. When you get a direct hit, I guess your body just vaporizes. You know, I know that happened a lot in Iraq and Vietnam when one of our bombs, and Japan, of course, the United States bombs is a direct hit, the bodies vaporize. So we'll see. You know, Trump certainly has pretty consistently talked against such things as occupying countries and holding them and controlling the territory. I mean, that's kind of what he ran on. It is, but then again, he seems to really love these generals, especially these Marine Corps generals, and that's his problem. That's his problem. His clear love for the military brass, and his great respect for them. And those guys are idiots, frankly. You know, I mean, they're not great thinkers. They're certainly not, you know, versed in. They're not versed in international relations. They don't understand geopolitics, for God's sake. I mean, they just don't. They don't need to. They're not required to. They understand only what they need for a particular mission. These are not deep thinkers. These are people who tend to react often emotionally, sometimes very, very well. Now, here's the other thing we can hope for, and I think this is very likely, that there will be a rebellion, and this could be very exciting. Like in Vietnam, if this really becomes a serious hot war, like in Vietnam, and I've been reading and writing about this recently, there could be a very serious rebellion within the U.S. military against this, and this could take many forms. This could take the form of passive resistance. During Vietnam, the Vietnam War, many combat troops would be sent out into the jungle on patrol missions, and instead of patrolling, they would just find a safe place to set up camp for a few days, and they would just sit there, and then they would come back and they would make up stories about having encountered Viet Cong and having shot them up, etc. There's also we now have evidence that more than 1,000. This is a good one. This is a good statistic. It's a statistic that it's like taking smelling salts. It wakes you up. It's harsh, but I have to say, kind of makes me feel good. And if you want to call me a bloodthirsty anarchist for it, so be it. We now know that more than 1,000 commanding officers were assassinated, fragged, it was called, by Vietnam U.S. GIs. This is well documented. The Department of Defense wrote a whole report about it. If we get to that point where we actually have troops in the desert again, fighting these Arabs for, or these Persians in this case, for no apparent good reason to most Americans, I could see stuff like that happening. Maybe not actual fragging, but a lot of passive resistance, a lot of refusal or dragging of feet, kind of like the slaves in the South, you know, in the old South that I've written about too. That's passive resistance. That's the kind of stuff that I love. You know, it's not marching in the streets. It's not issuing a manifesto. It's not giving speeches, but it is the most effective way to end a regime. The slaves' passive resistance, refusal to work well, as W.E.B. Du Bois said. He said, they could make us work, but they could never make us work well, because the whip will never make someone work well. It would only make them work enough to stop getting whipped. So if we see that kind of passive resistance among GIs, among American soldiers in Iran and in the military generally, and I think that's a real possibility at this point, you know, boy, will that make me happy. And boy, could that stop this war right in its tracks. Because you know what else about the Vietnam War that I've been learning? The Pentagon, the Department of Defense, State Department, the Johnson administration, the Nixon administration, Joint Chiefs throughout the 60s and early 70s, were highly aware of the GI rebellion, which is what they called it. It was a mass widespread rebellion that was largely passive. It was basically about taking drugs, getting drunk, and refusing to fight. You know, those are my people. Those are my heroes. Those should be our greatest American heroes. Vietnam War veterans, Vietnam War soldiers who simply refused, who got high instead of going out into the field to kill some Vietnamese. They're on our poster. They're going to be on my postage stamps when I have a country. So I would like to see that again. And the fact that I've met so many people, like so many people in my world since I started the podcast, and RU, are 35-year-old guys who came of age right after 9/11, became politicized on that side. They wanted to fight. A lot of them enlisted, went to Iraq or Afghanistan and decided, like John Karp, one of the guests on Unregistered, like Josh Childress, another guest on Unregistered, decided that this was bullshit, came back and became the biggest anti-war activist you'll ever encounter. So there's already, I think, an underlying, seems to me, just based on all these veterans I know who are truly anti-war, it seems to me that there's fertile ground for anti-war activism, agitation, and talk, even within the military. So, you know, if you are in the military, and a lot of people have come to RU events, I can think of about a dozen right off the top of my head, are veteran or in the military right now, or in the service right now. So, you know, I would say to all of you, keep that talk going among people who are enlisted, you know, people who are in the military. If the brass sees that the grunts don't want to fight, it becomes really difficult for them to push anything. That's what, and some people have argued, and I think this is really significant, I think it's a very big part of it, have argued that that's what stopped the Vietnam War, was the refusal of the American soldiers to fight the damn thing. So, you know, if these Trump lunatic morons do decide that they need to occupy Iran, invade and occupy it, yeah, I think we could have a draft. But in some ways, I almost want them to try it, because I am pretty sure they are going to fail miserably. I am pretty sure we, and not just me and my radical weirdo anti-war friends, I'm pretty sure that we, like hundreds of thousands or millions of Americans, will say, go fuck yourself. Go fuck yourself. And what you can do is you can imprison all of us, which would be impossible because our prisons are already full. Certainly can't execute all of us. I don't think they're going to be able to round up all of us either. So if it's a mass movement like that, good luck, buddy, no matter how crazy you are. Man, I'm thinking back to the first Iraq War, the Gulf War, 91. That's when I was very young. I was in the Bay Area, and I was a professional activist. I was a lefty activist, and That's when a bunch of us decided to run onto the Bay Bridge to block the Bay Bridge and protest. Every time I drive by that, I think about it. I tell people about it. Stupid. I wouldn't recommend that. I wouldn't tell my son to do that. It was a little dangerous. But, I feel this stuff. And when the day they started dropping bombs, I just remember driving in my car, listening on the radio to reports of bombs dropping on people and screaming. I was driving on the 580 in Oakland. This was 30 years ago. And screaming at the top of my lungs, just with fury, rage. No one was there. I wasn't virtue signaling. I haven't told anybody about this until right now. It's in my bones. You hate war, you know? By the way, 1917, this movie, I was very hesitant to see it. I thought it was going to be another Dunkirk, which is full of lies and almost glorifies the slaughter of beautiful 19-year-old boys for a reason that should never have been. They were on that beach for no good reason, if you read the history of this. And Churchill was a lying, mass-murdering psychopath, as far as I'm concerned. That movie really upset me, and I saw it with my son and tried to explain it to him afterward, you know. So I was worried. He wanted to see... Here's something I'll tell you guys. My son and I love war movies. I love war movies, but not the ones that are like that. Not the ones that are really realistic and that also pretend that these wars from history in particular were necessary, you know. So 1917, this movie that's just coming out now, Toby really wanted to see it. And I said, I don't think I can do it. You know, it just upsets me too much, especially, you know, with you and the fact that he's 18, draft age. He hasn't registered with Selective Service. And we're trying to figure out whether he should and what to do about that. They can hold his, if he doesn't, he will not be able to get student loans or any federal financial aid. That's the stick they have. I said they won't. He was worried about getting arrested or getting fined. I don't think they'll do that because there are so many young men who are just not doing it for whatever reason, not registering. But he hasn't registered yet. And if we can figure out a loophole for him not to register, you best believe he won't. if it gets down to it, I don't think it will. But if it gets down to it, he and I have been talking for years about where we're going to go. Because I'm not letting him get drafted. I'm not letting him go to a war. Nope. So, you know, that's down the road. I don't think that's anytime soon, but it's scary now. And it is a possibility. It's a real possibility that we need to be thinking about. So get out in the goddamn streets. This is an emergency. This is an emergency. And, you know, all these liberals and lefties, you know, if they're opposed to this war, but they weren't opposed to the last ones, this once, I will cut them slack, and I think you should too. We need all the help we can. If they're right-wing Republicans who have talked about killing Arabs, you know, very recently, but they're opposed to this war, cut them some slack. We need everybody. Aaron Mate, who's been really great, and he's a lefty socialist, great journalist, who's been awesome on the Russiagate hysteria nonsense. He said just that. He said, let's put our political differences, if we are anti-war, if we are opposed to this war, let's put our political differences aside. Let's join together and stop the goddamn thing, like we did in Syria and like we did in Vietnam. We can do it. We can really do it. And remember that Trump has no popular support virtually, except for his handful of, you know, his minority, small minority of hardcore fans. It's a small minority of Americans who are Trump fans, who are really Trump supporters. So it's the Democrats. That's it. I mean, so, you know, we know that Trump and his advisors are gung-ho to kill some Iranians, but it's going to be up to the Democrats. And if the Democrats fall in line with him, and I bet they will, especially the leadership, I don't think people like AOC will, but I do think the top leadership, people like Schumer and Pelosi, my gosh, they've never met a war they didn't like. And they never met a war they didn't support. These people are disgusting. They've been killing people for decades. This has been like a career for them, killing and incarcerating. That's Chuck Schumer's whole career, is killing and incarcerating. Joe Biden, for God's sake. I mean, one of the greatest warmongers there is, and the greatest mass incarcerator of all time in our country. He's the champion. I've talked about this before. He is the world champion of mass incarceration. He makes Vladimir Putin look like a pussy when it comes to locking people up in cages that are worse than Siberian prisons in many cases. Would you rather be in solitary confinement in Pelican Bay or a gulag? I don't know, man. That's a tough. I'm not sure. At least in the gulag, you have a chance of getting out and you have a chance of talking to some other human being. I digress. Let's stop this war. All right. So we have about half an hour, maybe 45 minutes to go. I'm sorry. I've just not been able to look at the chats. I've been too wrapped up in this thing. I'm too upset, too focused on this. But I know I trust all of you guys to do. I know what you're thinking. I know what you're going to talk about, but it's about getting the message out. So, and especially if you are in the service or attached to someone in the service, that's, I think, really important. If the soldiers refuse to fight, this is an old left-wing socialist communist position or strategy was to get the soldiers to go on strike, like workers. Because that's what they're also workers, you know, they're slaves. Slaves used to go on strike all the time. This is chapter two of Renegade History. This is what they did sort of every day. There were sort of basically low-level strikes all the time. They were refusing to work well. They just worked enough to not get whipped. So if we can continue, if we can get soldiers, we can create a movement within the military to just not to, and I think the thing to do is to tell people. The best thing to do is to not be noisy about it, not be loud. Don't even be known as anti-war, because then you'll get court-martialed. You'll get kicked out. It won't be useful to the movement anymore. Just encourage this kind of passive resistance, you know, just getting away with not obeying orders or obeying orders, but not perfectly, right? Doing little things just to put some sand in the machine. Put some sand in the machine. Mario Savio, the free speech movement hero in Berkeley in the early 1960s, gave this amazing speech, which I still think everyone should listen to, in which he said, "There comes a time when we must put our bodies on the wheels of the machine. We must stop the machine from working at all." And that's what soldiers can do. They can actually, without even being known to do this, they can stop or slow down the war machine. They're the ones. By going on what I would call passive resistance strikes. I've also been writing about and reading about, or I've written about this already, the passive resistance of Germans to the war in the 1940s. So this was what was widespread among German civilians and soldiers in the Wehrmacht, civilians and civilians in particular in the defense industries and the armaments industries in Germany. They just weren't working. they just refused to work. And by the 1943-44, when the Nazis were on the run, when they were retreating as fast as they could, they didn't have the cops to discipline all these workers. And so there was just sort of basically mass strikes all the time in the armaments industries right inside the Third Reich. So if they could do it, if the Germans, and these weren't Jews, these were Germans who were going on strike against the war then, if they could do it, we can do it now for sure. All right. Whew. All right. Where do we go now? This was supposed to be the 100th episode podcast of Unregistered, and it's still going to be. Oh, 1917. Sorry. Thank you for reminding me. 1917 turned out to be, I did go to see it with Toby. It's an amazingly good film. And the politics of it are not exactly what I would put out there. Although I sort of like the fact that they don't just sort of hammer you with anti-war propaganda. I mean, it is propaganda. What I'm saying to you is propaganda. It is very clearly an anti-war movie, though. And there's a really, the most important scene politically is probably the least cinematically interesting scene, and it's a cinematic masterpiece. I mean, the camera work, the cinematography in this movie is just like nothing I've ever seen before. You've probably read about it, but I highly recommend going to see it. I can't actually wait to see it again, and I don't even see movies twice. Much of the movie is just it's a really beautifully, beautifully shot action adventure war movie, although the depiction of the battle scenes, number one, is really what my dream looked like when I was 14 years old. It's really what I think the battle scenes in World War I looked like, according to all the things I've read about them. And then there's a really beautiful scene in the middle of it, in which there's just a bunch of grunt soldiers enlisted soldiers in the back of a truck, a convoy truck, who are just talking about how this is all bullshit. The war doesn't make any sense. They don't care anything about this. They're here because they were drafted. As were many or most of the soldiers in both world wars in all the armies who fought in those wars. Conscripts, slaves. But that really was it. I mean, that was really the kind of passive resistance and that kind of attitude that I think we need to foster among those who are in the military. That's really going to stop them from doing what they want to do. Now, they can always bomb from the air, and that's no fun, to say the least. They can kill lots and lots of people that way, but they can't really take control of the country from the air. They can't take control of the country with special operations forces. They can't take control of the country with drones. They just can't. They can kill a lot of people and maybe ask for concessions, but you know, you have to occupy with boots on the ground in massive numbers. You know, it's a real imperialist, colonialist thing you have to do. Trump has always talked against specifically doing that. I just hope that his moron generals haven't talked him into doing this. So we'll see. Get out there. Go see 1917. Incredible movie. Okay. So let's talk about unregistered. Yeah, it began in April 1917. The history of it is that I had, for many years, had been a guest on many podcasts, tiny podcasts. I remember the first podcast I was on. It was Kyle Platt. If Kyle Platt's out there, hey, Kyle, thank you for doing that. This was like in 2010, I think. I was on this tiny little podcast he had. I probably had 10 or 20 listeners. And I remember in the middle of it, I said, is this a podcast? Because I didn't even know what it was at the time. And it was fun. I enjoyed it. Something about it, something about the intimacy of the podcast format, I really took to. I had been on cable news a lot. I was on cable news shows a lot during those years, 2010, 2011, 2013, 2012, promoting my book, and just that became sort of a semi-regular talking head, especially on Fox Business. Sometimes on Fox News and others, but you know, I'd get flown out to New York a few times a year and I'd do these really frustrating 2 or 3 minute segments and then get flown back and, you know, no one would pay attention to it, but I couldn't get my ideas out, all of my ideas out in 3 minutes. But the podcast, you know, I found that being on Fox News did nothing for me. Like I didn't see any bump in like my Twitter followers. I didn't see any bump in my book sales. I didn't see anything, you know, it just didn't seem to do anything for me. But then I'd be on these podcasts, you know, and then School Sucks podcast was actually the first one that really showed me this. You know, School Sucks podcast is a successful podcast and has a significant audience. But it's, you know, it's in the 4 digits, you know, it's nothing like a TV show, but it didn't matter because I still, to this day, I mean, there are hundreds of people who have come to me and have taken Renegade University events and listened to the Unregistered podcast who found out about me from the School Sucks podcast. And I almost never, ever, I can't think of one person who's ever said to me, oh, I first found out about you because of that Fox News show you were on in 2012 or whatever it was. But I am constantly hearing about people still who heard about me first from me being on some podcast. And a lot of them are fairly small podcasts because the intimacy, the intensity of the podcast experience for the listener, you know, these people are almost, you know, they're almost literally in your heads and you develop a relationship in some ways with the host and with many of the guests. And so I started to become, and I recommend, it's Brett Vinat. It's the School Sucks podcast. I definitely recommend that for people, especially those who are interested in unschooling and homeschooling and critiques of the school system, the education system. I learned a lot from Brett and that show. And Brett and I actually put on several events with School Sucks and RU, co-sponsored several weekend events. And then that sort of continued. I was on, and from there I got onto more podcasts and bigger podcasts, and people started to notice me, and I became sort of wanted as a guest, and I guess I developed some fans, I guess, from that. And people started to tell me that I should have my own podcast. And then of course Rogan happens, I guess, in 2012, 2013, something like that. And that was just a fluke. I'm going to give a shout out to somebody, Jacob Maine. If you're out there, you know, thank you. I think Jacob was 18 or 19 years old at the time. I had been on a bunch of podcasts, people had said, you know, Rogan might have you on. I had very few connections to Rogan except for a couple of mutual friends. I didn't know if he'd ever heard of me. There was a day I was on Twitter and Jacob Main, this kid, I think he lives in Georgia, I think something like that, tweeted at that moment. He saw that I and Joe were on Twitter at the same time. And he just tweeted at both of us and said, "Hey, Joe Rogan, you should have Thaddeus Russell on your show." And right then Joe just said, "Sure, why not? Thad, DM me." That was the beginning of all of this. So I DM'd him. He said, you can be on my show, come back on. And I was on his show in a few months. And of course that just, you know, elevated my name, especially within podcasting. And then the second time I was on his show, which was about a year later, he said during the show, he said, "You should have your own podcast." And actually that was what really convinced me. You know, I said, "Huh, makes sense." So it was percolating in my mind for a while. And then I finally got up the nerve in 2016, I decided to do it. 2017, I started recording interviews. I went to New York and recorded the interviews with Malice, with Camille. Then I recorded an interview with Maggie McNeil in Portland, John Karp. Where was that done, John? Somewhere in the Northwest. Yeah. So let me talk about what unregistered has meant to me. I was pretty convinced that it would be a good show. I thought it would be worthwhile. I thought that I had some ability to talk to people. I thought that I had some ability to talk on a microphone, you know, and so I thought it would be worth a try. I did not expect it to be the thing in my professional career that I'm proudest of. I did not expect it to be the most fulfilling and satisfying and thrilling thing I have ever done professionally. It's not only professionally fulfilling, though, it is also personally been an absolute goldmine for me. I have developed a network. I've mentioned this before, a network of really good friends, of associates, of colleagues, of partners who are just beautiful people. And I am so proud and thrilled to be working with them and to be friends with them. And at this point, there's dozens of people who have contributed to the show and to Renegade University, but especially to the show in various ways. And a lot of it's just been unpaid labor and just volunteering and supporting it in all kinds of ways. And the list of people I can thank is immense. And I am hesitant to even do that because I don't want to leave anybody out, but I'll mention a few people. So when I started the podcast, I had never touched a microphone. See, I still am working on my skills a little bit here. I'd never done a podcast before. I didn't know how to do any audio engineering, any audio editing. I didn't even own the equipment. I didn't know how to get music. I didn't know what to do. So I read about it. Isaac Morehouse, I want to give a shout out to him. He helped me originally with some of that. But my friend in Salem, Oregon, Gabe Montgomery, who approached me in Costco in Salem, Oregon, when I moved there, he said, "Are you Thaddeus Russell?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Oh, I heard you on Rogan. Yeah, I'm a fan." And we became really good friends because Gabe's a great guy. And Gabe had some audio engineering, audio editing skills and also some musical skills. And he's a hip hop artist, and he was his hip hop producer has beats online. And anyway, I found the beat that became the theme song for Unregistered through Gabe. And Gabe put together that whole introduction that you hear. And he was the audio engineer and would accompany me also on the interviews to make sure that the audio recording was going well. I now do it myself, but I needed his help at the time. So for the first several episodes, that's all Gabe Montgomery, his work. And, you know, it was magic. I remember the first time when we were working on that intro, that theme music with my voiceover over it, that intro, when we finally got the timing down and we got my voice to actually flow over the beats a bit. And I heard it. I knew we had a show. So I want to say thank you to Gabe for that. And that was in April. And then, so I was on Rogan that month, which of course gave us a huge boost. I think our second or third episode, we reached the top 50 overall on iTunes podcasts. And for several months, we were in the top 100 in several categories on iTunes, in large part because of Rogan, but I think also because people like the show, and it really had legs. And then we had, you know, big guests like Gavin McInnes. I think that by now the episode with Gavin has gotten, I think, over 200,000 listens and views. It's remarkable. And Gavin himself said it was the best podcast he had ever done, which was great. But so, you know, I was elated. You know, I told Gabe at the time, it felt like there was this airplane that I'd been building with him and with other people and just by myself for a long, long time. And we didn't know if it was going to fly. It was like the Gray Goose. The Spruce Goose that Howard Hughes built, you know, the Leo DiCaprio movie, The Aviator, right? This giant, crazy looking contraption. And now it's time for liftoff. Is it going to actually, and I felt like this airplane actually was starting to take off. I felt like there was a demand, a desire, an interest in this. It was really, really thrilling. And I then started to hear things. I started to release and to reveal myself more and more in the show. You know, I think especially with John Karp, that started, you know, when I broke down there, and I realized that was really what is missing in a lot of political discourse and a lot of political shows like mine, is people talking about themselves in these ways and being vulnerable, like emotionally, and talking about how their own feelings and their own personal past is related to their political ideas. And that's, you know, one of the real, I think, that really sets it apart from, I think, just about any other political or politically oriented show. And it's why I love it so much, because here it is, guys. So I had, of course, been in some ways a public figure, just a minor one for a long time. I'd been a professor at big universities. I taught a whole bunch of undergraduates, hundreds and hundreds of them. And so I'd been speaking in public for decades, you know, by that point. I'd written two books, you know, I'd written articles, I'd op-eds, you know, I was out there, you know, my name was out there, my ideas were out there. Lots and lots of discourse from me, but never about myself. I never talked about myself, because you're not supposed to. When you're trained as an academic or even as a journalist, you're trained to keep that stuff hidden away, right? To be professional is to just talk about what your subject matter is. And, you know, I respect that in some ways. And you want to be clear, you want to be careful about not, you want to be clear about trying to be rational when you're making political decisions, et cetera. But, you know, if you know me, you know that I think that nothing is purely rational, right? And none of our political decisions, none of our decisions at all are purely rational. They're all informed by our history and by our feelings. And that, so what unregistered for me, the reason it's so, one of the reasons, there's several actually, one of the reasons that it's so fulfilling is that you hear and see all of me. I mean, I talk about almost everything, you know. There's a couple of painful things that I don't like to talk about that I haven't talked about, but my gosh, I have unloaded a lot onto you listeners over the last 2.5 years, over 100 episodes about myself, and my guests have too, and I've been just thrilled by that. Almost all of them have revealed things that he didn't reveal in any other show. They told me this, and you know this, if you're a listener, you know that that's a common thing on the show, that the guests will say things that they have never said before about themselves, and that's, it's the greatest honor. It's just the greatest honor to have someone tell you things like that. So you get to hear and experience me, all of me. And I feel, you know, I am being so honest and so candid in the show. And to have a positive reaction to that, to who I am, to who I really am, not just Thad the historian or Thaddeus Russell the historian or the journalist, but to Thad the person, you know, to have a positive reaction to that has meant the world to me. And maybe this is overly dramatic, but like if my career ends tomorrow, my life ends soon, if I know that I'm going to die in a week, I feel pretty good about my accomplishments just because of the podcast, you know, and that's apart from the book and the PhD and the teaching and the Art Renegade University. And, you know, just the podcast alone, I'm really, really proud of, and it makes me feel great. And the response to it by you guys, by the listeners, has been just So yesterday I got what I get almost every day. I got a long letter. I think this is an email. I get it. You know, I get emails. I get messages on Facebook Messenger a lot. I get comments on Twitter, various ways. Like people message me pretty much every day for the last 2.5 years. But I got a long letter from someone yesterday, just telling me how they grew up. They actually happen to be friends with Josh Childress, and they heard about me through Josh, but they grew up as conservative Republicans who supported the Iraq War, who supported the Afghanistan War, big pro-military guy, very conservative, culturally conservative. And he said through listening to the podcast, he is now like a pro-personal liberty, anti-war, you know, nut, just like me. But that's fine. I mean, people changing their politics is great, but the messages that really touch me, that really make the podcast worthwhile for me, that make it the most fulfilling, satisfying thing I've ever done, are the many, 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 many messages I have gotten from people who have said it has changed their lives personally. Josh Childress is a good example. You know, he said that listening to me talk to Connor Habib and Maggie McNeil about these sort of wild ideas, these crazy sex radicals and this sort of radical form of freedom, changed his ideas about being a border patrol agent, changed his ideas about chasing people through the desert and sending them back over to Mexico, to the point where he quit the border patrol, right? I never thought that, you know, listening to porn stars and sex workers would cause border patrol agents and cops to quit their jobs, but that's precisely what happened. And I got to say, I mean, if that was the only thing I accomplished with Unregistered, I'm going to die a happy man. I mean it, you know, I will die, or at least I will die feeling like I succeeded. You know, I did something in this world that I am proud of, and can't take that from me. So yeah, I get messages all the time, and I'll just say something for those of you who have sent me a message. The one problem is that a lot of people, and this is okay. I mean, I'm not upset about it, but people need to understand. I get a lot of messages that ask me questions about history and philosophy, which I talk about often and have written about often, you know, either on the podcast or in my books or in articles or whatever. And I can't respond to those. You know, I mean, if you ask me about, I get people asking me to sort of reiterate my arguments about slavery or about the American Revolution or about the mafia or crime or whatever it is. I can't respond, or I'll just say, you know, you can read my book. But when I get messages that just simply thank me for the show or say, you know, thank you for the show and it's changed my life in these various ways, I will always respond. I will always respond. I have to. I mean, that's just, you know, I never thought I'd have that effect on people. I mean, it's just the greatest accomplishment. I don't think there's anything better. I don't think there's any prize. The Pulitzer's bullshit compared to that, you know, the Nobel Peace Prize. I mean, the Bancroft Prize in American History, I think I mentioned this, you know, which is the top prize in American history. That used to be what we all were going for when I was in grad school. That was like, ooh, like, nah, like one person telling me that their life was changed for the better by listening to me. Dude, I don't need anything else. I'm good. And I've gotten that, as I said, almost daily for 2.5 years. Wow. So, Lily, what should I talk about? Someone thinks I'm a fraud. Oh, I bet I know why. let's. This was supposed to be for you guys, so I'm gonna do another 30 minutes here. All right. I think we've talked about Iran. We can certainly talk about that more if you want to. I would love to talk about specific episodes, specific guests I've had. I can give you some inside baseball on that. You know. I can tell you about what I think are some of my favorite episodes, what I think are some underrated episodes. I can tell you about, you know, what people were like. It's easy because with very, very few exceptions, I have basically loved my guests. I mean, there have been a couple who were pain in the ass, but my gosh, I mean, more than 90% of my guests I think are great, and I'm basically friends with them, and some of them are close friends and became close friends because of it. But All right, let's do that. Why don't you guys just throw out, you could just throw out names of guests or episodes that you want me to talk about. And I'd love to. It's great pleasure. Derek Varn. Fidelia, see, Derek Varn was one of my favorites. Yeah, it's interesting. I'm really glad. The Kamasi Hill episode, I got a lot of good response, and I was really glad about that. I wasn't sure about him, but I wasn't sure that the episode would be as popular as it was, but it has been. So let's talk about Derek, and I'll talk about Kamasi. Shane Lee, another great one. Yeah. Thank you. This is really fun. So, of course, Lily. We can talk about Lily a lot. And Gavin. So Derek Varn. Yeah. I was surprised at how well that was received. You know, it's a tough episode for a lot of people because it's so highly intellectual. Derek kind of knows everything. If you guys think that my knowledge base is impressive, it's not much compared to his in terms of, like, I mean, that guy knows everything about politics, and he knows everything, especially about obscure political movements, but that are important and interesting in certain ways. And I had heard him, Derek, on Doug Lane's podcast, and I just thought he was super impressive, just an amazing intellect and just incredibly talented, and had also really good politics, even though he's firmly on the left. And I want to do another show with him because I think he was a little bit, I think it was hard for him, he was a little nervous. He had his own podcast, but he had not been on a show this big. And I think, you know, he had really been kind of pushed. I was pushing him a little bit in that interview, and he was nervous. I would love, if you want to hear a really extraordinary mind, listen to Derek Varn. Go to his, you have to be deep into politics and in a particular sort of radical fringe politics, but, you know, there is just no one smarter that I have come across, Derek. And you should, let's see, his show is called, If you go to the Zero Books podcast, it's one of them. It's called something like, he has a couple, but anyway, I'm blanking on it. But he's on the Zero Books podcasts many times. There's several of them. Highly recommend that. And that was great. Kamasi just happened in Chicago. So I've known, well, if you listen to the episode, you sort of know the story, but, like, so 10 years ago when the book came out, he found out about it and was like, whoa, wild, and just sounds good. And I got a communication, I think it was Facebook, from this guy named Kamasi Hill. I was like, oh, shit, he's black. Oh, my God. You know, and I was terrified of the response to the slavery chapter in particular. My editor was just told me that we were not going to mention the slavery chapter ever in any of the promotions because it would be death to the book. So, I mean, I stand by it. I think I think if anything, it's pro-black, not an anti-white, but, you know, and Kamasi understood that. And I was like, wow, holy crap. You get it. This is great. Like, you get it. And he's who introduced me to Shane Lee, another fantastic, one of my favorite guests on Unregistered. We had an incredible time when I was in Houston. Love that episode. Go listen to that episode. That's not hard to listen to if you're not like super politically sophisticated. Yeah. Because we talk about things like Tyler Perry, but in a very smart way. And we talk about movies in a very smart way and sports, you know, and we just clicked. Shane's an amazing guy, and we think in very similar ways, and he's been sort of persecuted in similar ways that I was in academia. But I love that one. And let's see, what else? Lily wants me to interview my son. I guarantee you that's not going to happen, nor would I make him do that. Toby has like, you know, he's a teenage boy and he's my son. So it's not like, he's not like rah, rah, yay, dad. Although I think he's proud of it. And he did listen for a while. He stopped. A lot of it's, and now he's getting into politics too. Deirdre McCluskey. God, that was fun. Thanks for bringing that up, Ryan. Ryan, the ruling boys. Love you guys. So Deirdre McCluskey, I walk into this apartment in downtown Chicago. It's one of these restored industrial lofts, you know, brick walls, two levels, it's beautiful, just beautiful. Like, and she is just the warmest, friendliest person you're going to meet. She's also a goddamn encyclopedia of all knowledge. I mean, we just sit down, and before we even start going, she's just throwing out knowledge bombs. I mean, she just knows everything, you know? And I'd been wanting to talk to her for years about bourgeois virtues, you know, because she's a big champion of bourgeois virtues, and I'm a big critic of bourgeois virtues. I think, although they've gotten a lot of bridges built, which is good, but you know, that's my work has been basically one big critique of bourgeois virtues. And so it was fascinating to talk with her and to really get into it. There's a struggle we had. We argue, you know, we argued for like an hour about this, and it was a great back and forth. And it was really a high level mind bending exercise for me. And, I loved it, but her generosity of spirit and her true, she is a true intellectual. She really just wants to talk about ideas, and she will not get offended to the point where she won't talk to you. She's ready to talk about anything at any time. I love that more than anything. Reminded me a bit of the Heidi Matthews, and people are bringing up Heidi Matthews here, and I love it to see that. The Heidi Matthews episode. I think, I hope this doesn't offend anybody, but I know it won't offend Heidi. I told her this. Just in terms of intellectual quality, that was, I think, the best unregistered episode. We went to places that I had never gone, and she pushed me, you know, to rethink things, and she pushed me to really think hard. That was the hardest I've ever thought, sort of intellectually, during an episode, was with Heidi. And but it was wonderful. Like she expanded my mind and made me really think through my stuff about consent and about sexual assault and about sex and sexuality generally. Highly recommend that episode if you want to get really into those issues and feminism. Heidi is genius, such a smart person, and boy, are we lucky to have her as faculty for Renegade University. We have not gotten her set up yet with her office hours, but we will soon. And we've got to find a course to have her teach. If you have any ideas about what courses you would like Heidi or anyone to teach, let us know. Let me know right now. We can get that going and get it online right away for you. Here's Jason developed a crush. Oh, you developed a crush on Heidi in New Orleans, Jason? I'm going to tell her that. Dutch says Heidi is the best. You guys, yeah, these are people who are in the Renegade University New Orleans. Heidi went down there on her own dime, by the way. Or no, I think it was University of Toronto's dime, but still. Basically spent the weekend debating people because she's a socialist and debating RU people. And it was phenomenal. They loved it. The RU people, who were all anti-socialists, just loved her being there and loved talking to her. And she was just blown away. She's like, wait a minute, you know, people who are, we're not right wingers, but you know, people who are anti-socialists don't usually talk to me like this. So it was what we're about. You know, it was like a real contest of ideas. And Camille Foster was there that weekend too. And so Camille and Heidi got into it too, but it was never rancorous. It was just intense, and it was fascinating. And like everybody on both sides said, I never get to do this. I never get to debate with someone who has a fundamentally different idea about the world. It was one of the great successes, I think, in the history of both the podcast and Renegade University. So I wanted to mention, if you guys keep throwing out names, I love talking about particular episodes. Jason, this guy, Christian Petrolini, isn't this the guy? I think this was when he was on Sam Harris, right? Yes. He was on the Sam Harris show, a live show at some big auditorium in Dallas. And this was during the Q&A, some woman, and I still don't know who this is. I'd love to know, but got up and said to Sam Harris, will you have a conversation with Thaddeus Russell? And Sam Harris said, nope. he has, what did he say? He has ideas about me that I don't understand, and so I don't think it would be productive, and so no. And then but then Christian Petrolini, his guest on the stage, said, I'm in favor of it. and Harris just said, noted, and moved on. Jim Goad. Okay, there's a good one. Clay Houston, is Gavin McInnes as funny in person? Okay, let me tell you this story. So, even more so, if anything, if that's possible. I think Gavin's politics are all kinds of fucked up in all kinds of ways. I don't care, but like, it's, you know, clearly he and I differ radically on most things or many things. I don't care. I think he's just the funniest, possibly the funniest person I know. So we hung out with him for like a few hours before we recorded that, and then a few hours, and then I was on his show, which was a blast, by the way. And then we did my show right after that, and then we hung out because Gavin said he didn't want to go home because he was drinking and didn't want to see his wife when he was drunk. So he spent like 2 or 3 hours with us at that bar where we recorded it. We recorded it in a bar, which was perfect too. And everybody in the bar knew him, and he got like this whole special section of the bar closed off for us so we could interview him in quiet. You know, it was great. But so Paul, I gotta talk about some people too. My producer and partner Paul and I were there, and Paul and I were basically doubled over like in laughter the entire time. He was imitating his dad, doing that whole Scottish accent thing. It was like he did his own stand up for us, and it was insanely funny. So Gavin is a remarkable talent. If you want to see an interesting video that'll kind of change your mind about Gavin, he did a video, a lot of you probably have seen this, with his baby son, I think. It was a baby, in which he sort of pretend he plays fighting with his kid, like pretending to beat him up when he's like an infant. It's really funny, and it kind of shows the sweetness of Gavin. He's not a bad guy. He's a good guy. He's got feelings like the rest of us, and he loves his kids. Let's see, who else do we want to talk about? We could talk about Lily and that whole thing. I think I've talked about it a lot. Acapulco, interviewing Lily in a Fleabag hotel in downtown Acapulco a week or 2 weeks after her husband had been murdered, and we didn't know if there was still a bounty on her head. We didn't know who the murderers were. We didn't know if they were still coming to get her. There was zero security at that hotel. I shouldn't have done it. I told myself going down to Acapulco that I would not do such a thing. I would only interview Lily in a very secure place. But when I got there, I got the call. I said, hey, she can meet you at this place in an hour. Will you be there? And I showed up, and it was just this sort of wide open hotel with no security, cheap hotel right in old Acapulco, you know, outside the tourist zone, which is the safe zone. And it was terrifying, but really one of the most powerful experiences of my life. And then Lily and I, of course, developed a very close relationship. We became very close friends. I am going to go to Mexico again, I think at the end of February, and I'm going to interview Lily again. I'm also going to interview Jason Henza, who has been grossly ignored in all of this. He was shot 6 times when John was killed. So I'm going to interview Jason and Lily again, and we're going to talk about what it was like after that, because that's a big part of the story with Lily and me, was what we went through together between sort of February when John was killed and really till now. But I mean, especially like the first like 3 or 4 months, we talked every single day on the phone. Every single day we talked on the phone. I was going through my own stuff at the time. And I was ending a relationship. By May, I was on the road, essentially nomadic. I moved out of Oregon. I've been out of Oregon since then. A long-term relationship. So it was very traumatic. And I was really on my own for the first time in a long, long time. But also liberated in some ways. It was hard. And so we really, I think, kept each other afloat and alive. And I really needed her. And she really, I think, needed me. She was isolated. She was under basically self-imposed house arrest to avoid arrest and deportation during that time. She had no one to talk to. I was, I think, one of the only people she was talking to for quite a while. And it's a very, very important relationship. Lily now has an incredible boyfriend, Bernardo, and they live in a beautiful town in the mountains in Mexico. And it is makes me so happy. I can't even stand it. And I can't wait to see them and meet them. Yeah. Let me say, let's see, we got about 12 minutes left. So I mentioned the beginning of the podcast, how it started, and my friend Gabe, who was my first audio engineer and really put it together and made it sound good and made me believe in it. A month after it started and it had an audience and it, you know, these two guys approached me, AJ Van Slyke and Paul Maresca, and they had been producers for other podcasts, and set up monetization schemes for other podcasts, other podcasters. And they approached me and said, we want to do this for you. We believe in you. We think that you can do a lot of things. You can bridge the gap between the left and sort of the libertarians. They said, we think you can be like a Marc Maron, in terms of broadening the audience and establishing a mainstream audience, because you talk about people and feelings and histories and personal biographies. And they, for very little money for a while, and then nothing but sweat equity for a long time, they built this. They built the infrastructure for Unregistered. They built the infrastructure, especially for Renegade University, especially Paul. The whole website is Paul. Just the day-to-day operations, you know, it was AJ and Paul for a long time. Now it's mostly just Paul. AJ is now an advisor for us. And it's without them, I don't know what I would have done, but I am always eternally grateful to those two men for getting me where I am. And I hope every time I do something, every time I record an episode or I record a live stream, I just hope it's good enough for them, because I owe them and I want to honor them and their work. And I want to make sure that what they've done is worthwhile for them. I really, they invested in me a lot, and I want to pay them back, and I want to pay them back big time. And I will do that, I think, because we have something really special here. We have something special in the fans, in the listeners, in the response it gets. And I've been getting, now that I've been in the Bay Area, I've been getting more and more people listening who are kind of liberal lefty types, you know, just from sort of personal networking, just from my personal relations. It's been getting out into various worlds that I never thought I would go into. So, you know, women who listen to NPR and, you know, good old fashioned Berkeley communists and stuff, you know, are listening to the show and seem to like it, even though it pisses them off a lot. And they find me quite interesting and quite exotic. I'm trying to figure out why on earth I would have these ideas. But it's, I love this show, and I love it. You know, there's sort of like, I'd say in my whole life, you know, there's, you know, the birth of my son, I guess getting a PhD, Columbia, writing Renegade University, publishing it. You know, those would be the big three, but Unregistered is it. It is all of me. You know, it's funny when I meet people who have listened to the show a lot, I forget that they know everything about me, you know? So I'll mention something personal and they say, yeah, I know about your son, and I know you did this, and I know you're a recovering alcoholic, and I know, you know, it's like they know all this stuff. You get all of me. And when you give yourself out like that to the public, just open up to the public, and you get positive responses, you know, for the most part, it's incredibly, it's just wonderful. Now, you know, as a lot of you know, I get a whole lot of hate too every day. I get still to this day, I think pretty much every day, I get a message or two from somebody who wants to tell me that I'm an idiot, mostly because of what I said about gender and race on Rogan and to some extent, you know, postmodernism and all that, you know. And that's all fine. And we're still doing that. And the good news is that the postmodernism course was our best-selling course and still is. And we have a new version of it that's out now. It's coming out now. And, you know, it's just the cross I have to bear. What can I say? It's the most difficult argument to make. And I'm apparently the one who's chosen to make it, you know, in public. Do you lift weights, Thad? I lift weights a little bit, but I get tennis elbow from it. I don't know. But yeah, I'm back in the boxing gym. That's really good. King's Boxing. King's Boxing Gym, the home of Andre Ward, world champion, Olympic gold medalist. That's where I'm training and working out now with the great Mr. King and his coaches there. And if you're ever in Oakland, oh, by the way, if you're ever in Oakland and want to get a workout or just hit a bag, come to King's Boxing Gym. It's the only serious, real deal, old school boxing gym in the East Bay, I think in the entire Bay Area at this point. And it's got just the walls are festooned with pictures of old boxers and Andre. It was Andre Ward's home gym and a lot of champions' home gyms. It's great. So you might see me there if you want to come down. Any other questions? Anything? I'm more than happy. Got like 7 minutes here. If you want to talk about what else can we talk about? Any episodes of Unregistered? We can talk about plans for Renegade University. Let's talk about Renegade University right now. All right. So we, as I'm sure a lot of you know, or all of you know, we have a brand new website, thanks to Paul. We put it up online just a few months ago. We basically had our launch of the new RU with the new website, the new platform, new courses, new faculty. We have this new interactive mechanism called office hours, where you can talk one-on-one with me or any of the instructors. And then we have the Quad, which is our own social media platform within Renegade University, which of course, you know, the government ain't going to censor it unless they actually try to shut us entirely down. Facebook and Twitter can't censor us, can't tell us what to say. It's wonderful. We've got the platform working, there's no serious bugs with it. People are on there talking. If you're a member of the Unregistered Underground, that's where you're going to end up. We're going to move you over there, not forcibly, but it'll be a very peaceful transition for you. But that's where all the conversation is going to happen. That's where we're going to build a whole new world. I'm building a whole world. We are building a whole new world. I mean, academia and the media just said, nope, we can't have any dissident voices, anybody who thinks differently. And that's not just for me. That's for, you know, basically much of the podcast world is sort of exiles just like me, right? The so-called intellectual dark web. That's what that's all about. You know, that's what we have in common. So we have to build our own jobs, our own careers, our own universities, our own worlds, our own social networks. And that's what we're doing. We got the platform and now we're just going to do it. So we've got courses on race, on the history of race, which I just did. You can go there. It's amazingly shot. Another person I need to give a shout out to is Dutch, who is he shot the race course in his house in upstate New York, put me up, been a wonderful guy, great supporter. And it's beautiful. Stan Rosario, another guy who came to three RU weekends and told us he was a video editor. And we said, oh, really? Let me see your work. And he showed us. And he's like a top flight Hollywood video editor, which is why our courses now look beautiful. Look at the new courses. Look at the new postmodernism course, the new race course. Daniel Coffeen's Nietzsche course, beautiful. Just we're making art now, and they're getting better and better and better. So the standards are up high for us. Thanks, Dutch. Love you too. We have a whole bunch of ideas for events. We haven't decided on any yet, but we're thinking strongly about doing something in San Francisco, the San Francisco Bay Area, very soon. I have a couple of ideas. One is I'm thinking about doing an alt tech conference. There's a bunch of startup firms that I've been talking to here that are like kind of re-envisioning the whole internet. Like they're not just tinkering with like this alt coin or doing, you know, this app or something, but they want to remake the whole internet. And it could be really something else to have that conversation live and to do some maybe courses with them. I also, Daniel Coffeen, you know, I think is continuing to be a star for us. He is one of our best professors. I think he's a brilliant, charismatic speaker. His course on Nietzsche has been very popular. It's been selling a lot. Daniel's a good friend of mine, and he and I have been talking about doing some kind of a live event, maybe either a weekend in San Francisco, the San Francisco Bay Area, with him and maybe with someone else. If you would like that, let us know. And then I'm going to be in, when I'm in Mexico in February, I'll be scouting Lily. She and I will be scouting out locations. We want to do retreats. We want to do longer, like 4 or 5 day retreats that, where we really get into things and really talk and also have more time to do sort of, recreational stuff and have fun together. We're also this incredible course that we're finishing editing right now. I'm now doing the final cut myself, or I'm doing my cut for it. It's called Instructional Design for Dying. It's by Tom Nichol. A lot of you may know about this. He was a guest on the show. It's a practicum course. It's basically cognitive behavioral therapy. It's about a 6-hour long course. There's homework involved. There's exercises you do. And based on my own experience with dialectical behavior therapy, which is a form of a similar kind of therapy, I am totally convinced that if I take this course, and I just told Tom yesterday, I called him up when I was editing it. I said, man, if I take this course, I know my life is going to be better. When you prepare for your own death, it turns out, this is his whole argument, and I'm convinced by it. When you prepare for your death throughout your life, you will live a much better life. Your fear of death declines, and you become much more comfortable with your own life as it is. It's a remarkable, remarkable exercise. I think it's going to just go like gangbusters. I think once people find out about this, it's going to be useful, not just for people who are, you know, older or thinking they're about to die, but people in their 20s and 30s. If you take this course, you'll see that it will make you feel better. Your anxiety will be reduced, and your fear will be reduced, and you will take care of unresolved issues in your life that you wouldn't want to take to your deathbed. And that's what the course is all about. I can't wait to take it with Tom, and I can't wait to tell you about it. We're going to do another interview for the podcast about it. So that's coming out very soon as well. And then, this is exciting too, another good friend, another podcast guest, another RU faculty, Daniele Bolelli. The great Daniele Bolelli. We are shooting his History of Martial Arts course this, we're doing it next Monday. And hopefully that'll be ready to go within a few weeks. Oh my goodness. So there's nobody better qualified to teach this course than Daniele, the great podcaster, the podcaster of the History on Fire podcast, which had more than 100,000 listeners to every episode. Now he's with he's behind a paywall. I forget the name, with Luminary. But, you know, he's a major podcaster. He's been on Rogan many, many times. And he's also an expert, a world expert on martial arts. He wrote a seminal book, a cult classic book on the philosophy of martial arts, Walking in the Warrior's Path. Daniele knows everything about this. And I love it because, of course, this is something I'm excited about. It's a lot, you know, a lot of people in our world are into martial arts. But that's going to come out soon as well. We have Maggie McNeil, the great Maggie McNeil, another person who's been very just integral in all of this and unregistered and RU since the very beginning. She's got her course that's already up and online. You can take it on the politics of sex work. It's absolutely brilliant, of course, because it's Maggie McNeil. And you will learn everything you need to know about sex work, which is, I think it's going to be one of the great civil rights movements of our generation. And I think that, and I've told her this many times, I believe that in our lifetime, we will legalize sex work in this country, and in large part because of her work and in the work she's been doing with us. All right. It's been an hour and a half. The 100th episode of Unregistered is about to be in the can. We will release this shortly. Do we have any more questions? Any more comments? Just want to say again, and I really mean this, I love you guys. It's bullshit, because look, I'm doing what I want to do. I live a blessed life. This is, I told someone today, I have a great life. I worry all the time. I'm anxious all the time. I'm stressed all the time. But this is what I want to do with my life. And you have made it possible. So thank you. Thank you for there being 100 episodes of Unregistered. Thank you for being here today. Thank you for your support. Thank you for asking tough questions. thank you for being so goddamn smart. I mean, my God, I know that the listeners of Unregistered are the smartest people in the podcast world. Oh yeah. I'll put you guys up against anybody. We should have like a contest, like a College Bowl, you know, the little quiz show contest, right? We'll take all the big, you know, we'll take Sam Harris's fans, and we'll take Jordan Peterson's fans and Joe Rogan's fans, Dave Rubin's fans, all of them. And we'll just have a contest, and we'll do an IQ test, because they're big into IQ. You guys are going to win. I love you very much. Lily, thank you for being a great moderator once again. I hope you didn't have to take too many people out this time. And I'll see you guys soon. All right. Love you. Bye and peace. This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To experience the new Renegade University, go to renegadeuniversity.com. Thanks for listening.